Strickland said. When we signed on, we were promised resources and freedom of a kind most of us had only dreamed about. When I started, I thought I could make a real difference. I was terribly, terribly wrong, and I will never be able to apologize enough. Prax's blood was singing. A warmth spread from the center of his body, radiating out to his hands and feet. It was like being dosed with the most perfect euphoric in the history of pharmacy. Her hair smelled like the cheap lab shampoo he'd used to wash dogs in the laboratories of his youth. He stood too quickly, and her mass and momentum pulled him a few centimeters off the floor. His knees and feet were slick, and it took him a moment to realize he'd been kneeling in blood. "What happened to these kids? Are there others somewhere else?" Amos asked. "These are the only ones I was able to save. They've all been sedated for evacuation," Strickland said. "But right now we need to leave. Get off the station. I have to get to the authorities."
"And why do you need to do that?" Amos asked.
"I have to tell them what's been going on here," Strickland said. "I have to tell everyone about the crimes that were committed here."
"Yeah, okay," Amos said. "Hey, Prax, you think you could get that?"
He pointed his shotgun at something on a nearby crate. Prax turned to look at Amos. It was almost a struggle to remember where he was and what they were doing.
"Oh," he said, "sure."
Holding May against him with one arm, he took Strickland's gun and trained it on the man.
"No," Strickland said. You don't understand. I'm the victim here. I had to do all this. They forced me. She forced me."
"You know," Amos said, "maybe I'm coming across as what a guy like you might call working class. Doesn't mean I'm stupid. You're one of Protogen's pet sociopaths, and I ain't buying any damn thing you're trying to sell."
Strickland's face turned to cold rage like a mask had fallen away.
"Protogen's dead," he said. "There is no Protogen."
"Yeah," Amos said. "I got the brand name wrong. That's the problem here."
May murmured something, her hand reaching out behind Prax's ear to grip his hair. Strickland stepped back, his hands in fists.
"I saved her," he said. "That girl's alive because of me. She was slated for the second generation units, and I pulled her off the project. I pulled all of them. If it wasn't for me, every child here would be worse than dead right now, worse than dead."
"It was the broadcast, wasn't it?" Prax said. "You saw that we might find out, so you wanted to make sure that you had the girl from the screen, the one everyone was looking for."
"You'd rather I hadn't," Strickland said. "It was still me that saved her."
"Actually, I think that makes it Captain Holden," Prax said. "But I take your point." Strickland's pistol had a simple thumb switch on the back. He pressed it to turn the safety on. "My home is gone," Prax said, speaking slowly. "My job is gone. Most of the people I've ever known are either dead or scattered through the system. A major government is saying I abuse women and children. I've had more than 80 explicit death threats from absolute strangers in the last month. And you know what? I don't care." Strickland licked his lips, his eyes shifting from Prax to Amos and back again. "I don't need to kill you," Prax said. "I have my daughter back. Revenge isn't important to me." Strickland took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Prax could see the man's body relax, and something on the dividing line of relief and pleasure appeared at the corners of his mouth. May twitched once when Amos's auto shotgun fired, but she lay back down against Prax's shoulder without crying or looking around. Strickland's body drifted slowly to the ground, the arms falling to the sides. The space where the head had been gouted bright arterial blood against the walls. each pulse smaller than the one before. Amos shrugged.
Or that, Prax said.
So, you got any ideas how we...
The hatch behind them opened and a man ran in. What happened? I heard... Amos raised the auto shotgun. The new man backpedaled, a thin whine of fear escaping from him as he retreated. Amos cleared his throat.
Any idea how we get these kids out of here?
Putting May back in the transport cart was one of the hardest things Prax had ever done. He wanted to carry her against him, to press his face against hers. It was a primate reaction, the deepest centers of his brain longing for the reassurance of physical contact. But his suit wouldn't protect her from the radiation or near vacuum of Io's sulfuric atmosphere, and the transport would. He nestled her gently against two other children while Amos put the other four in a second cart. The smallest of them was still in newborn diapers. Prax wondered if she had come from Ganymede too. The carts glided against the station flooring, only rattling when they crossed the built-in tracks.
You remember how to get back to the surface? Amos asked.
I think so, Prax said.
Doc, you really want to put your helmet back on.
Oh, right, thank you. At the T-intersection, half a dozen men in security uniforms had built a barricade, preparing to defend the lab against attack. Because Amos tossed in his grenades from the rear, the cover was less effective than the locals had anticipated. But it still took a few minutes to clear the bodies and the remains of the barricade to let the carts roll through. There was a time, Prax knew, that the violence would have bothered him. Not the blood or bodies. He'd spent more than enough time doing dissections and even autonomous limb vivisection to be able to wall off what he was seeing from any particular sense of visceral horror. But that it was something done in anger, that the men and women he'd just seen blown apart hadn't donated their bodies or tissues, would have affected him once. The universe had taken that from him, and he couldn't say now exactly when it had happened. Part of him was numb, and maybe it always would be. There was a feeling of loss in that, but it was intellectual. The only emotions he felt were a glowing, transforming relief that May was here and alive, and a vicious animal protectiveness that meant he would never let her leave his sight, possibly until she left for university. On the surface, the transports were rougher, the wheels less suited to the uneven surface of the land. Prax followed Amos's example, turning the boxes around to pull them rather than push. Looking at the vectors, it made sense, but it wouldn't have occurred to him if he hadn't seen Amos doing it. Bobby was walking slowly toward the Rocinante. Her suit was charred and stained and moving poorly. A clear fluid was leaking down the back.
Don't get close to me, she said. I've got protomolecule goo all over this thing.
That's bad, Amos said. You got a way to clean that off?
Not really, she replied. How'd the extraction go?
Got enough kids to start a singing group, but a little shy of a baseball team, Amos said.
May's here, Prax said. She's all right.
I'm glad to hear that, Bobby said. And even though she was clearly exhausted, she sounded like she meant it.
At the airlock, Amos and Prax got in and nestled the transports against the back wall while Bobby stood on the rough ground outside. Prax checked the transport indicators. There was enough onboard air to last another 40 minutes.
All right, Amos said. We're ready.
Going for emergency blow, Bobby said, and her armored suit came apart around her.
It was a strange sight, the hard curves and layers of combat plate peeling themselves back, blooming out like a flower and then falling apart, and the woman, eyes closed and mouth open, being revealed. When she put her hand out for Amos to pull her in, the gesture reminded Prax of May seeing him again.
Now, Doc, Amos said.
Cycling, Prax said.
He closed the outer door and started fresh air coming into the lock. 10 seconds later, Bobby's chest started to pump like a bellows. 30 seconds, and they were at 7/8 of an atmosphere.
"Where do we stand, guys?"
Naomi asked as Prax opened the transport.
The children were all asleep.
May was sucking on her first two fingers the way she had when she was a baby. He couldn't get past how much older she looked.
"We're solid," Amos said. "I say we get the fuck out of here and glass the place."
"Eh, fucking men,"
Avasarla's voice said in the background.
"Copy that," Naomi said. "We're prepping for launch. Let me know when you've got all your new passengers safely in."
Prax pulled off his helmet and sat beside Bobby. In the black sheath of her base garments, she looked like someone just coming back from the gym. She could have been anybody.
"Glad you got your kid back," she said.
"Thank you. I'm sorry you lost the suit," he said. She shrugged. "At this point, it was mostly a metaphor anyway," she said. And the inner airlock opened.
"Cycle's done, Naomi," Amos said. "We're home."
Chapter 52. Avasarala. It was over, except that it wasn't. It never was. "We're all friends now," Souther said. Talking to him without lag was a luxury she was going to miss. "But if we all limp back to our corners, we're more likely to stay that way. I'm thinking it's going to be a question of years before either of our fleets are back up to what we were. There was a lot of damage."
"The children?"
"Processing them. My medical officer's in communication with a list of doctors who deal with pediatric immune problems. It's just about finding their parents and getting them all home now."
"Good," she said. "That's what I like to hear. And the other thing?"
Souther nodded. He looked younger in low gravity. They both did. Skin didn't sag when there was nothing to tug it down, and she could see what he looked like as a boy. "We've got transponder locks on 171 packages. They're all moving sunward pretty fast, but they're not accelerating or evading. Pretty much we're standing back and letting them get close enough to Mars that disposal is trivial."
"You sure that's a good idea?"
"By close, I mean still weeks away at current speed. Space is big." There was a pause that meant something other than distance.
"I wish you'd ride back on one of ours," Souther said.
"And be stuck out here for another few weeks with the paperwork? Not going to happen. And besides, heading back with James Holden and Sergeant Roberta Draper and Mei Meng, it has all the right symbolism. Press will eat it up. Earth, Mars, the outer planets, and whatever the hell Holden is now."
"Celebrity," Souther said. "A nation of its own."
"It's not that bad once you get past the self-righteousness. And anyway, this is the ship I'm on, and there's nothing it's waiting to repair before it starts its burn. And I've already hired him. No one's giving me any shit about discretionary spending right now."
"All right," Souther said.
"Then I'll see you back down the well."
"See you there," she said, and cut the connection.
She pulled herself up and launched gently across the ops deck. It would have been easy to push down the crew ladder shaft, flying the way she'd dreamed of as a child. It tempted. In practice, she figured she'd either push too hard and slam into something, or else too gently and have air-resistant stopper with nothing solid close enough to reach. She used the handholds and pulled herself slowly down toward the galley. Pressure doors opened at her approach and closed behind her with soft hydraulic hisses and metallic bangs. When she reached the crew deck, she heard the voices before she could make out the words, and the words before she saw the people.
"Have to shut it down," Prax was saying. "I mean, it's false pretenses now. You don't think I could be sued, do you?"
"You can always be sued," Holden said. "Chances are they wouldn't win."
"But I don't want to be sued in the first place. We have to shut it down."
"I put a notice on the site so it gives a status update and asks for confirmation before any more money gets moved."
She pulled herself into the galley. Prax and Holden were floating near the coffee machine. Prax wore a stunned expression, whereas Holden looked slightly smug. They both had bulbs of coffee, but Prax seemed to have forgotten his. The botanist's eyes were wide and his mouth hung open, even in the microgravity. "Who's getting sued?" Avasarala asked.
"Now that we have May," Holden said, "Prax wants people to stop giving him money."
"It's too much," the botanist said, looking at her as if he expected her to do something about it. "I mean, surplus funds?" Avasarala asked.
"He can't quite retire on what he's got," Holden said. "Not in luxury, anyway."
"But it's yours," Prax said, turning to Holden with something like hope. "You set up the account."
"I took the Rocinante's fees already. Trust me, you paid us generously," Holden said, hand out in a gesture of refusal. "What's still in there's all yours. Well, yours and May's."
Avasarala scowled. That changed her personal calculus a little. She'd thought this would be the right time to lock Prax into a contract, but Jim Holden had once again ridden in at the last moment and screwed everything up.
"Congratulations," Avasarala said. "Has either of you seen Bobby? I need to talk to her."
"Last I saw her, she was heading for the machine shop."
"Thanks," Avasarala said, and kept pulling herself along. If Praxitiki Mung was independently wealthy, that made him less likely to take on the job of rebuilding Ganymede for purely financial reasons. She could probably work the civic pride angle. He and his daughter were the face of the tragedy there, and having him running the show would mean more to people than all the facts and figures of how screwed they'd all be without the food supplies back online. He might be the kind of man who'd be swayed by that. She needed to think about it. Once again, she was moving slowly and carefully enough that she heard the voices before she reached the machine shop. Bobby and Amos, both of them laughing. She couldn't believe that she was walking in on an intimate moment, but it had that tickle fight sound to it. Then May shrieked with delight, and Avasarala understood. The machine shop was the last place in the ship, with the possible exception of engineering, that Avasarala would have thought about playing with a little girl. But there she was, arms and legs flailing through the air. Her shoulder-length black hair flowed around her in a whirl, following the gentle end-over-end spin of her body. Her face was bright with pleasure. Bobby and Amos stood at opposite ends of the shop. As Avasarala watched, Bobby caught the little girl out of the air and launched her back toward Amos. Soon, Avasarala thought, the girl would start losing her milk teeth. She wondered how much of all this May would remember when she was an adult.
"Are you people crazy?" Avasarala said as Amos caught the girl. "This isn't a playground."
"Hey there," Amos said. "We weren't planning on staying long. The captain and the doc needed a minute, so I figured I'd haul the kiddo down here, give her the tour."
"When they send you to play catch with a child, they don't mean that she's the ball," Avasarala said, moving across to him. "Give that child to me. None of you people has any idea how to take care of a little girl. It's amazing you all live to adulthood."
"Ain't wrong about that," Amos said amiably, holding out the kid.
"Come to your nana," Avasarala said.
"What's a nana?" May asked.
"I'm a nana,"
Avasarala said, gathering the child to her. Her body wanted to put the child against her hip, to feel the weight bearing down on her. In microgravity, holding a child felt odd. Good, but odd. May smelled of wax and vanilla.
"How much longer before we can get some thrust? I feel like a balloon floating around in here."
"Soon as Alex and Naomi finish maintenance on the drive computers, we're out of here," Amos said.
"Where's my daddy?" May asked.
"Good," Avasarala said. "We've got a schedule to keep, and I'm not paying you people for floating lessons. Your daddy's talking to the captain, Mamie.
Where?
The girl demanded.
Where is he? I want my da.
I'll get you back to him, kiddo, Amos said, holding out a massive hand.
He shifted his attention to Avasarala.
She's good for about 5 minutes, then it's where's daddy?
Good, Avasarala said. They deserve each other.
Yeah, the big mechanic said.
He pulled the child close to his center of gravity and launched up toward the galley. No handhold for him. Avasarala watched him go, then turned to Bobby. Bobby floated, her hair sprayed softly out around her. Her face and body were more relaxed than Avasarala remembered ever having seen them. It should have made her seem at peace, but all she could think was that the girl looked drowned.
Hey, Bobby said. Did you hear back from your tech guys on Earth?
I did, Avasarala said. There was another energy spike, bigger than the last ones. Prax was right. They are networked, and worse than that, they don't suffer lag. Venus reacted before the information about the battle could have reached it.
Okay, Bobby said. That's bad, right?
It's weird as tits on a bishop, but who knows if it means anything? They're talking about spin entanglement webs, whatever the hell those are. The best theory we've got is that it's like a little adrenaline rush for the protomolecule. Some part of it is involved with violence, and the rest goes on alert until it's clear the danger's past.
Well, then it's scared of something. Nice to know it might have a vulnerability somewhere.
They were silent for a moment. Somewhere far off in the ship, something clanged and May shrieked. Bobby tensed, but Avasarala didn't. It was interesting to see people who hadn't been around a child react to May. They couldn't tell the difference between pleasure and alarm. Avasarala found that on this ship, she and Prax were the only experts in children screaming.
I was looking for you, Avasarala said.
I'm here, Bobby said, shrugging.
Is that a problem?
I don't follow. Is what a problem?
That you're here.
She looked away, her expression closing down. It was what Avasarala had expected.
You were going down there to die. Only the universe fucked you over again. You won. You're alive. None of the problems go away.
Some of them do, Bobby said. Just not all.
And at least we won your game.
Avasarala's cough of a laugh was enough to set her spinning slightly. She reached out to the wall and steadied her drift.
That's the game I play. You never win. You just don't lose yet.
Ehrenreich? He lost. Sorin? Nguyen? I took them out of the game, and I stayed in. But now? Ehrenreich's going to retire with extreme prejudice, and I'm going to be given his job.
Do you want it?
Doesn't matter if I want it. I'll be offered it because if the bobblehead doesn't offer it, people will think he's slighting me. And I'll take it because if I don't, people will think I'm not hungry enough to be afraid of any longer. I'll be answering directly to the Secretary General. I'll have more power, more responsibility, more friends, and more enemies. It's the price of playing.
Seems like there should be an alternative.
There is. I could retire.
Why don't you?
Oh, I will, Avasarala said. The day my son comes home.
What about you? Are you looking to quit?
You mean, am I still planning to get myself killed?
Yes, that.
There was a pause. That was good. It meant Bobby was actually thinking about her answer.
No, she said. I don't think so. Going down in a fight's one thing. I can be proud of that. But just getting out to get out, I can't do that.
You're in an interesting position, Avasarala said. You think about what to do with it.
And what position is that, Ronin?
A traitor to your government,
and a patriotic hero. A martyr who didn't die. A Martian whose best and only friend is about to run the government of Earth.
You're not my only friend, Bobby said.
Bullshit. Alex and Amos don't count. They only want to get into your pants.
And you don't?
Avasarala laughed again.
Bobby was at least smiling. It was more than she'd done since she'd come back. Her sigh was deep and melancholy.
I still feel haunted, she said. I thought it would go away. I thought if I faced it, it would all go away.
It doesn't go away. Ever.
But you get better at it.
At what?
At being haunted, Avasarala said. Think about what you want to do. Think about who you want to become. And then see me, and I will make it happen for you if I can.
Why? Bobby asked. Seriously, why?
I'm a soldier. I did the mission. And yes, it was harder and stranger than anything I've ever done, but I got it done. I did it because it needed doing. You don't owe me anything.
Avasarala hoisted an eyebrow.
Political favors are how I express affection, she said.
Okay, people, Alex's voice said across the ship's PA. We're back up and commencing burn in 30 seconds unless someone says otherwise. Everybody get ready to weigh something.
I appreciate the offer, Bobby said. But it may be a while before I know if I want to take it.
What will you do then? Next, I mean.
I'm going home, she said. I want to see my family. My dad. I think I'll stay there for a while. Figure out who I am. How to start over. Like that.
The door's open, Bobby. Whenever you want it, the door is open.
The flight back to Luna was a pain in the ass. Avasarala spent 7 hours a day in her crash couch, sending messages back and forth against different levels of lag. On Earth, Sadavir Ehrenreich was quietly celebrated, his career with the UN honored with a small and private ceremony, and then he went off to spend more time with his family or farm chickens or whatever he was going to do with the remaining decades until death. Whatever it was, it wouldn't involve wielding political power. The investigation into the Io base was ongoing, and heads were quietly rolling on Earth. But not on Mars. Whoever in the Martian government had been bidding against Ehrenreich, they were going to get away with it. By losing the most powerful biological weapon in human history, they'd saved their own careers. Politics was full of little ironies like that. Avasarala put together her own new office in absentia. By the time she stepped into it, it would already have been running for a month. It felt like driving a car while sitting in the back seat. She hated it. In addition, Mei Meng had decided she was funny, and spent part of each day monopolizing her attention. She didn't have time to play with a little girl, except that, of course, she did. So she did. And she had to exercise so that they wouldn't have to put her in a nursing home when she got back to a full G. The steroid cocktail gave her hot flashes and made it hard to sleep. Both her granddaughters had birthdays she could only attend on a screen. One had 20 minutes lag, one had 4. When they passed the cloud of protomolecule monsters speeding in toward the sun, she had nightmares for 2 nights running, but they gradually stopped. Every one of them was being tracked by 2 governments, and Ehrenreich's little packets of death were all quiescent and speeding quietly and happily toward their own destruction. She couldn't wait to be home. When they docked on Luna, it was like a starving woman with a slice of apple touched to her lips, but not allowed to bite. The soft blue and white of the daylight planet, the black and gold of night. It was a beautiful world, unmatched in the solar system. Her garden was down there, her office, her own bed. But Arjun was not.
He was waiting for her on the landing pad in his best suit with a spray of fresh lilacs in his hand. The low gravity made him look younger, too, if a little bloodshot about the eyes. She could feel the curiosity of Holden and his crew as she walked toward him. Who was this man that he could stand to be married to someone as abrasive and hard as Christian Avasarala? Was this her master or her victim? How would that even work?
Welcome home, Arjun said softly as she leaned into his arms. He smelled like himself.
She put her head against his shoulder, and she didn't need Earth so badly any longer. This was home enough.
Chapter 53. Holden.
Hi, Mom. We're on Luna.
The light delay from Luna was less than 6 seconds for a round trip, but it was enough to add an awkward pause before each response. Mother Elise stared out at him from his hotel room's video screen for 5 long heartbeats. Then her face lit up.
Jimmy, are you coming down?
She meant down the well. Coming home. Holden felt an ache to do exactly that. It had been years since he'd been to the farm in Montana that his parents owned. But this time, he had Naomi with him, and Belters didn't go to Earth.
No, Mom, not this time. But I want all of you to come meet me up here. The shuttle ride is my treat, and UN Undersecretary Avasarala is hosting, so the accommodations are pretty posh.
When there was comm lag, it was difficult not to ramble on. The other person never sent the subtle physical cues that signaled it was their turn to talk. Holden forced himself to stop babbling and wait for a reply. Elise stared at the screen, waiting out the lag. Holden could see how much she'd aged in the years since his last trip home. Her dark brown, almost black hair was streaked with gray, and the laugh lines around her eyes and mouth had deepened. After 5 seconds, she waved a hand at the screen in a dismissive gesture.
Oh, Tom will never ride a shuttle to Luna. You know that. He hates microgravity. Just come down and see us here. We'll throw a party. You can bring your friends here.
Holden smiled at her.
Mom, I need you guys to come up here because I have someone I want you to meet. Remember the woman? Naomi Nagata? The one I told you about? I told you I've been seeing her. I think it might be more than that. In fact, I'm kind of sure about it now. And now we'll be on Luna while a whole lot of political bullshit gets straightened out. I really want you guys to come up, see me, meet Naomi.
It was almost too subtle to catch, the way his mother flinched 5 seconds later. She covered it with a big smile.
More than that? What does that mean? Like getting married? I always thought you'd want kids of your own someday.
She trailed off, maintaining an uncomfortably stiff smile.
Mom, Holden said, Earthers and Belters can have kids just fine. We're not a different species.
Sure, she said a few seconds later, nodding too quickly. But if you have children out there... She stopped, her smile fading a bit.
Then there'll be Belters, Holden said. Yeah, you guys are just going to have to be okay with that.
After 5 seconds, she nodded, again too quickly.